The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Caron, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Transfusion Medicine Update in Review is presented by Dr. Elena Kier.
Hello. I was trying to think of a witty title, and that's all I could come up with. I don't have any sort of acronym for anything, but let's see. I have no disclosures. These are my objectives. I wanted to briefly overview some of transfusion medicine, review some manufacturing. I'm not really going to talk about indications or contraindications too much, but we'll talk about the overview of the infectious risk, transfusion reactions, which have something to do with the fever lecture that we just heard, which was excellent, and then, of course, the American Society of Hematology Choosing Wisely campaign. According to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, along with the FDA, approximately 4 million patients every year receive red cells. Every 2 seconds, someone in the United States needs blood. And the need is great, but the donation is great too. Approximately 7,000 units of platelets and 10,000 units of plasma are transfused every day. Millions of other patients get component therapy, which is something that we'll cover today as well. I tried to put all of the history of transfusion medicine onto one slide, but that was impossible, so bear with me. Transfusion really started in 1628. Dr. William Harvey discovered what he called circulation, and it was in animals, not in people at that time, but things progressed, and in 1665 at Oxford University, the first transfusion of animal-to-animal blood occurred. It was transfusion of blood from one dog's carotid artery to an internal jugular vein of another dog, and the dog did well and survived, and they thought, hey, in 1667, why don't we give some of that blood to a human and see what happens? And actually, they transfused cow's blood and sheep's blood, and the first patient did quite well, and it was only 5 to 10 mLs. Unfortunately, another patient suffered likely a classic transfusion reaction and died, which really put a halt on transfusion medicine. It was actually outlawed in France and England and stayed pretty dormant until approximately 1818, when Dr. William Blundell transfused approximately 15 mLs into a postpartum female who was hemorrhaging. She did well, she recovered, and people thought, hey, this isn't such a bad thing. Fast forward to 1900s, Dr. Carl Landsteiner discovered that serum agglutinated with red cells of patients from different populations and therefore gave us our blood groups. Initially, they were called A, B, and C, but of course, C has now been changed to O. The long-term anticoagulants were developed in 1914, and right around the advent of World War I, military started to set up blood depots, as they called them. And actually, the first successful blood depot was set up by an American Army officer, and he's really credited. His name is Oswald Robertson, and he's credited with the foundation of blood banking as we know it. Typically in the United States, this is how blood is manufactured, and we'll talk about this more in detail. I know the picture can be a little bit overwhelming. But the overall thought is that we should only give to patients what it is they truly need. But how do we get it? What are the risks of it? I know I'm going a little fast with the slide, so please bear with me. I have a lot to say in 20 minutes. The contents of anticoagulant preservative solutions in each red cell bag can be different. Most of them contain some sort of CPD or citrate phosphodextrose combination. It depends on which one as to how much and how long the red cells can be stored. The ACD is the most common. It's now usually only used for platelets. The CPD and CP2D, I guess I can't really highlight anything, but right towards the middle of the table, allow blood to be stored for 21 days. The CPDA1 uses an adenine solution that allows the blood to be stored for 35 days. And if you add just pure adenine saline to red cells, it allows the shelf life to extend to 42 days. This is just a little clearer of a table. You can see the red cells and whole blood range for 21 to 42 days. Frozen red cells, and I'll talk about those as well, can be stored for up to 10 years at a minus 65 degree temperature. Washed red cells are stored for about 24 hours. And platelets, which everyone has a pet peeve, and platelet transfusions are mine, but platelets can be stored for 5 days, but if you notice, they're stored at 20 to 24 degrees, which is what makes them separate. You cannot freeze platelets, you should not have cold platelets, or it will destroy the product. Perfect. There's been many, many guidelines set up in the past 10 plus years for recommendations on transfusions. I only listed four here, although of course, surgeons have different guidelines, critical care have different guidelines, but I listed the American Society of Hematology, the Choose and Wisely campaign, anesthesiology, and the American Association of Blood Banks. I wanted to go through the schema, but we'll start with red cells. Whole blood, as we know it, is the original blood product. In this day and age, it is very rarely used outside of the military setting. It is most commonly used for massive transfusions, such as those on the battlefield, when someone's lost approximately 30 to 40% of their blood volume. The key to this is that a whole blood transfusion needs to be ABO identical. It contains everything: plasma, white cells, platelets, and anticoagulant solution. So it's my attempt at some transitioning in a PowerPoint slide. But there was a study published in 2013 called the Randomized Controlled Pilot Trial of Modified Whole Blood versus Component Therapy, or CALBIT study. And it looked at 300 patients over 4 years with a goal of trying to determine whether whole blood in severely injured patients would result in fewer transfusions than component therapy. The study overall did not notice that there was a decrease in transfusion. So whole blood was not proven to be any better than component therapy. But if you read through the study, the sensitivity analysis did show that using whole blood in patients with neurological injuries did allow to decrease the overall fluid volume. So maybe it's better, maybe it's not. I know we don't use it due to lack of availability. Red blood cells is the most common thing that we are all familiar with here. We order them and we transfuse them. And most commonly, the red cells in this country are prepared by centrifugation and removal of other components. Typically, they contain approximately 200 to 200 mLs of pure red blood cell product. Red cells, along with platelets, can be further modified. And this is the question I get asked a lot of, what do we need to do to them? Do we have to leukocyte reduce them, or wash them, or freezing, or irradiate them? And I wanted to clarify some of those points a little better. The first one is leukocyte reduction of red blood cells. So this is done with a leukocyte reduction filter. It was hard for me to believe, but leukocyte reduction is not a mandate in this country, unlike in Europe. So not every product, not every red cell will be leukocyte reduced. It depends on the institution that you practice in. Our institution only utilizes leukocyte reduced red cells. The benefit of that is it decreases the risk of CMV by 99.99% due to the fact that the CMV virus lives on the monocyte. The other issue is that approximately only 85% of the original product remains after leukocyte reduction, so there is some waste. I don't have to read the benefits to you, but the reason that leukocyte reduction is mandated in Europe is due to the risk of prion disease. I guess here our cows are safe and we don't have to worry about mad cow. I'm never good with jokes, but I'm gonna throw some in anyway. So then we can also wash red cells. The shelf life, unfortunately, does decrease significantly. You also have to use approximately 1 to 2 liters of saline to wash the cells. Why would you do this? This really is beneficial in one type of patient, and that patient is an IgA deficient patient who truly will have an anaphylactic reaction to red cells that have not been previously washed or treated. The issue with it is that most hospitals do not have the ability to do this, but large blood centers do. So depending on where your hospital orders blood, I'm certain they can do this for you if truly needed. red cells can be frozen, and you can freeze a red cell bag with the addition of glycerol for up to 10 years at 65 degrees or minus 65 degrees. The benefit is that you can store rare autologous units. The issue is that after glycerol is added, you have to really deglyceralize the unit prior to administrating it to a patient. If you don't do that efficiently and adequately, you can run into a hemolytic transfusion reaction, which can be even more complex if it really is a negative unit that you only have a certain amount of. But this can absolutely be done. The American Red Cross has a very large depository of frozen units. Red cells can be irradiated, and that's another issue that comes up a lot as to what benefit does it give us. Well, it truly helps for those patients with immunosuppression. Immunosuppression due to leukemia, certain lymphomas, due to certain chemotherapy, those patients that are getting intrauterine transfusion, those patients that are requiring blood from a first-degree relative or first-degree relative donation. You do not have to irradiate products in solid organ transplant patients, and you also do not have to irradiate products in your HIV patients. Where are we? Platelets, excellent. I like them, but I also feel like they're a little dirty since they always sit at 20 to 24 degrees. Platelets do not require pre-transfusion cross-matches. You can give ABO-incompatible platelets because the RhD antigen is not present on the platelet. Standardly, in a normal, healthy adult, I'd like to say 70-kilogram adult, but I don't think that's the standard anymore. One single donor apheresis unit typically increases the platelet count by 25 to 35,000. And this is a table that I found that probably doesn't even need to be in table, but what it states is essentially if your platelet count is low, you will bleed. But the number has made it seem like a good thing to put on the PowerPoint. There are two main types of platelets. One of them is the apheresis platelet, and that's approximately 85% of the platelet product in this country. That is a platelet that is done by direct donation, by one person coming in, donating the platelets, they become an apheresis unit. The other way to obtain platelets in this country is a pool platelet, which is really a byproduct of processing. You pool approximately 5 to 6 different patient red cells. When you start to separate things, the platelets come out. What is the difference and what is the benefit? Well, I can tell you that there is a cost difference between the two. Our center, an apheresis unit is approximately $500. And we buy our blood from Michigan Blood because we're in Michigan. I used to work for the Red Cross, and I think the cost was very approximately the same. The reason that you would want an apheresis platelet versus a pooled platelet is that it decreases the risk of exposure to different donors and different antibodies that could be transmitted. The pooled platelets, on the other hand, for highly exposed patients may actually give them more of a benefit because it's more of a mathematical chance of match. Platelets can also be leukocyte reduced, just like their compatriots, the red cells. It does not prevent transfusion-associated graft versus host disease, but it does allow to decrease the risk of CMV infection and febrile non-hemolytic transfusion reactions. Of course, you also do lose some of the product. Oh, did I miss one? Platelets can also be irradiated, and that is what truly helps with transfusion-associated graft versus host disease. I listed some of the other indications on the table. Of note, only red cells and platelets truly do need irradiation since they're the only two cellular products. Platelets can be washed, and their lifespan is approximately 4 hours post-wash. This can be done for hypersensitivity, for the neonatal or a baby transfusion, or to remove unwanted electrolytes. Platelets can also be volume reduced. And two scenarios that I see this sometimes is neonates. I currently don't work with children, but in my transfusion medicine fellowship, we did cover the neonatology service and transfusions. When you're talking about a 5 ml or a 7 ml transfusion, you do want the best product and the largest volume of product to be given. You lose approximately 20% during that process. The last part of my table here is the cryoprecipitate and plasma derivatives here on the bottom. Cryoprecipitate used to be used a lot, and I feel now that it's really, I wouldn't say fallen out of favor, but I think we forget about it as part of our standard transfusions. Cryoprecipitate used to be commonly given to patients with hemophilia, whether it's hemophilia A or be along with patients with von Willebrand's. Now we recommend the use of recombinant coagulation factors for both of those patient populations, but of course cryoprecipitate remains there as it contains factor 8, von Willebrand factor, factor 13, and fibronectin in an emergency or in a rural setting, or if the patient maybe didn't know they had von Willebrand's disease. The use of fibrinogen also remains for uremic thrombocytopathy in preparation of fibrin glue, or DIC. Fresh frozen plasma can sometimes be controversial, especially when it comes to reversal of certain lab values if we need a biopsy or if there's maybe a risk of bleeding. But it's typically derived from plasma separated from blood. It can increase the level by approximately 20-30% per unit, and it helps reverse the INR in certain specific situations, although it's not the standard recommendation for it. It contains fibrinogen, it contains no viable white blood cells. Okay, so now that I talked about all the products, any questions? I wanted to talk about the transfusion reactions that given those products can cause. All right. And I won't read this slide to you, but there's two main kinds. When you think of transfusion reactions, you either have a fever or you don't have a fever. If you have a fever, you have an acute or a delayed reaction in that category as well. If you don't have a fever, you can also have an acute or delayed transfusion reaction. This is a nice table that I found, and what it does is it compares the adverse effects of red cell transfusion per unit to a risk from other factors. So if you look to my left, wherever HIV is, I guess on the right, HIV and hepatitis C can be compared to airplane fatalities and lightning strikes. But on the other hand, things like taco, which is not a delicious lunch food, I know this is right before lunch, but and fever are actually less occurrent than death from medical error. This is a table of fatalities attributed to transfusions released by the FDA from 2010 to 2014. You can tell that most of the fatalities are centered right around transfusion-associated acute lung injury, or TRALI, which remains the number one cause of death from transfusion in this country. In 2015, the FDA received a total of 62 fatality reports. 42 of those were associated with transfusion-related events, and 20 of them were related to donor fatalities. And I was actually a little curious how a donor fatality happens, but the report didn't go into it further. My assumption is either allergic reaction to the prep, or maybe a volume issue, or perhaps a cardiac event during donation. The overall comparison of transfusion-associated fatalities reported from 2011 to 2012 lists TRALI at 38% as the number one cause and highest cause of mortality due to transfusion. It's followed by TACO, or transfusion-associated circulatory overload, followed by hemolytic transfusion reactions due to ABO incompatibility and non-ABO incompatibility. I wanted to take more time to talk about TRALI, which is transfusion-related acute lung injury. It is a pretty acute onset. It can happen within the first 1 to 2 hours after a transfusion and fully manifest within 6 hours. It's very important to distinguish this from a circulatory overload, as the treatments would be very different. You usually get a chest radiograph, which would show bilateral infiltrates, which could be either. You can get an ABG, which should show a pulmonary artery wedge pressure less than 18, but also you need to prove that there's a lack of cardiac dysfunction, a lack of atrial hypertension. The patients will be hypoxemic. The important thing about TRALI is that it is very highly reversible. Approximately, I think the numbers were 80% of patients with proper therapy, with actually IV fluids, pressors, sometimes intubation, will get better in 48 to 96 hours and survive this. Unfortunately, if TRALI is not recognized, patients will die. So this little table is how TRALI occurs. There's two main hypotheses right now, but the little PMN up there is a granulocyte that tries to squeeze itself through the lung capillary on its way into circulation. The problem is that the granulocyte and the lung capillary are very similar in size, so sometimes it gets stuck. This stuck or activated granulocyte is really the key to development of TRALI. The first hypothesis is that transfused antibodies will further activate the granulocyte that's there and promote a further leukoagglutinate, which then will sort of grow on itself and cause trolley. And that's B going into C. The second thought, and that's called immune-mediated trolley, sorry. The second thought is that in severely ill patients, the granulocyte is already activated or primed by the severe illness. So then when you give them a transfused product that also has some bioavailable antibodies in it, they will attach and then activate everything together. And that's kind of C going down further. And that is called non-immune trolley. The treatment for both would be the same. As I mentioned, the transfusion-associated acute lung injury has been implicated as the number one cause of death due to transfusion reactions. But the number overall has been going down in the recent years. There's been some things that the transfusion community has done, along with all of medical community, to decrease that. We overall try to only transfuse the amount and the type of product that the patient needs. The other issue that's helped, or sorry, the other thing that's helped is leukoreduction. But the one thing that people may not know is that typically female donor plasma is not utilized for transfusions. Transfusion medicine physicians have found that female donor plasma contains a high level of antibodies, especially if the plasma is from a multiparous female. And usually it's male plasma that we transfuse in the hospital in the acute setting. Female plasma then goes to research or to the making of component therapy such as IVIG. But that in itself, with the decrease of those antibodies, has helped decrease the number of trolley. So following an acute hemolytic transfusion reaction. So the most common cause for these are an ABO incompatibility or preformed antibodies to incompatible product. And when we think to ourselves, how do you give someone ABO incompatible blood? And a lot of times, unfortunately, these are clinical errors that happen in the hospital. The patients will suffer from fever, chills, back pain. I've heard them say impending doom, nausea, vomiting, renal failure. Unfortunately, these are mostly fatal, especially depending on how much blood has been given. However, with aggressive care, some patients do turn around. In 2015, there were 6 reports of fatal hemolytic transfusion reactions in this country. The incidence per 1 unit of red cells transfused is somewhere between 1 in 500 to 1 in 850. Which, when we think that we're transfusing millions of components of therapy, seems kind of high, but transfusion-related sepsis, and this is where, honestly, my hatred for the platelet comes back again. But since platelets sit in a warm environment at room temperature, they are actually one of the highest reasons for transfusion-related sepsis. It is a rapid onset of high fever, chills, rigors, hypotension due to bacterial entry into the donor's blood through either the donation site because of maybe a cleaning issue or an antiseptic issue, or a pre-existing bacterial infection that the donor may not recognize in themselves. This can be seen with platelets, this can be seen with red cells. I have seen a red blood cell unit with Yersinia transfused to a patient, and since the blood bank always keeps a little sample in case there is a transfusion reaction, it can be tested for after the unit has been transfused. This is a table from 2015, and it shows that 1 red cell and 4 platelet units were identified as the cause of transfusion-associated sepsis. And then on the bottom, it kind of lists some of the things that have been in there. So staph epidermidis, coag-negative staph, Klebsiella, and even 1 West Nile virus. I won't go into this table, but this is a close-up of it. So transfusion-associated circulatory overload, or TACO, I thought would be a good last transfusion reaction, especially because it's before lunch. But it's really an overload. It's too much volume in a certain population. The common mechanism for this really goes deeper and is part of a congestive heart failure result due to the volume that you have received with the transfusion. Patients with CHF, very young patients, patients with renal failure, those with chronic anemias are most at risk. And the treatment is diuretics and slow infusion and oxygenation. This does not preclude from further transfusions in the future. aside from transfusion reactions and, of course, the infectious risk, I thought this table was a good example as to what is the true infectious risk. So the most common infection is typically hepatitis C that could be transfused to your patients, followed by, hepatitis B, followed by hepatitis C, and then the risk of HIV. Unfortunately, even in 2017, the blood supply is not 100% safe, but I typically tell my patients it is 99.99% safe. Just depends on how far you want to carry out that decimal point. The last part that I wanted to cover are some guidelines published by the American Society of Hematology. The American Society of Hematology tries to guide us in better transfusion practices. And as a hematologist oncologist, it's the number one body that I typically listen to when it comes to further recommendations on hematology things. They recommend red cell transfusions, of course, for the treatment of symptomatic anemia, prophylaxis of life-threatening anemia, exchange transfusions, and really do warn us to be cautious in transfusion for patients with anemia that can be treated with other ways, such as B12 anemia or folate deficiency or iron deficiency anemias. The American Society of Hematology put out an ASH Choosing Wisely campaign in 2013. And there's 10 topics altogether. I think the presenter after me will cover one of them as well. But I wanted to sort of talk, four of them apply to transfusion medicine. The first recommendation is not to transfuse more than the minimum number of red cells necessary to relieve the symptoms of anemia. And standardly, the critical care literature publishes kind of a 7 and 21, or hemoglobin of 7, hematocrit of 21. But really, that is in a healthy patient without cardiac issues, without fluid issues. But that's one thing we need to think about. The other one is, do we really need to give 2 units for every time we give a transfusion? Our group has put in practice of giving 1 unit and then, of course, rechecking and giving another unit if necessary. It does take more time, and you do have to talk to your patients about it, but most patients do seem to understand. And if they don't, I throw in the infection risk and try to scare them into my way of thinking. But that's also controversial. The next part of the campaign is the administration of plasma. So ASH recommends not to administer plasma or prothrombin complex concentrates for non-emergent reversal of vitamin K antagonists. Of course, if there is major bleeding, clinical scenarios and clinical complications always trump recommendations, no pun intended, but it's just something that we need to be cognizant of and think about. And the last one is to really think carefully prior to transfusing patients with ITP. So immune thrombocytopenic purpura can result in bleeding, and it can result in a very scary low platelet count. But it's important to remember that the platelets these patients have do work properly, and they will typically not bleed. Of course, it's the typically. If they bleed, please give them platelets. And I think that's all I had. Thank you.